It's time now for the first of tonight's proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall, overnight to Katie Derham.
Sean, thank you, and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall for a prom of high passion and colour, a highlight of which will be the fifth and final appearance at the proms this year by pianist Paul Lewis, whose marathon cycle of all Beethoven's piano concertos has been warmly feted this summer, and which comes to a climax tonight with the epic fifth, or The Emperor. That, plus interludes from a modern opera called The Sacrifice by one of our greatest living composers, James Macmillan, making its London premiere, and Respighi's marvellously florid Pines of Rome. All will be performed, I have no doubt, with panache and élan by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra under its musical director, French conductor Stéphane Deneuve. He will set this evening off, though, with another burst of Roman excitement, Berlioz's overture, Roman Carnival. Now, when his opera, Benvenuto Cellini, was first performed in 1838, the only bit anyone liked was the overture, but the composer was rather reluctant to lose so much good music from the rest of that benighted work, so he pillaged it, and he used the best bits as a basis for another concert overture, the one that we're about to hear now. It is a real showcase for any orchestra. It's brilliantly scored, it's tough to play, but always, always makes an impact. Well, you can hear the Royal Scottish National Orchestra tuning up on the stage here in this packed Royal Albert Hall tonight, another sellout. The draw, the lure of Paul Lewis completing his cycle of Beethoven concertos is hard to resist. But now coming onto the stage is Stéphane Deneuve to conduct the Royal Scottish National Orchestra in Berlioz's Roman Carnival Overture. conducted, performed, and received with huge enjoyment. Berlioz's Roman Carnival Overture, performed there by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and conducted by Stéphane Deneuve, a conductor for whom the adjective flamboyant has been invented. He's congratulating for the second time the Cor Anglais player. But earlier he brought the whole orchestra to their feet. And he's doing so again. Listening to that is incredible, isn't it, to think that when Berlioz arrived in Paris at the age of 18, the son of a country doctor, he was a complete musical innocent. He'd never even heard an orchestra play. But that soon changed. I think we just heard the proof of that. Well, the stage is now going to be reset for Paul Lewis's performance of Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto. In the first 2 weeks of this year's prom season, he performed the first four concertos to great acclaim. One critic said that he'd never heard Paul Lewis play better and said he was refreshingly direct and keenly articulate at all times. Well, since then he's had time to concentrate on this last performance and reflect on this epic cycle. He said he's had a ball so far, but that it is nice to be at this particular stage where there is just the one more to focus on. But my, what a piece. The Fifth, or the Emperor, a name which Beethoven most emphatically did not give this piece, certainly possesses a grand and majestic character, and as the last piece he wrote for the piano, it can of course be regarded as the pinnacle of his achievement in the genre. Well, earlier I asked Paul specifically about the challenges of playing it.
It's an epic, it really is. And I don't mean to underplay the heroism of the character and the majesty of it. Of course, it's there, but it's just not the whole picture. And I do worry sometimes that, you know, we come to expect certain things from performances of these famous pieces based on the sort of legend of their character rather than the whole picture as it is. The big challenge with this piece is to try, in the context of this symphonic character and this symphonic scale of it, to try to get across the chamber-like passages convincingly. It varies, of course, from performance to performance because, you know, you're with different orchestra, different conductor, different hall, different piano. But probably most importantly in this sense is the hall, is the acoustic. It'll be a challenge in the Albert Hall because, you know, it's a big place. You have to really project everything to the roof. But in a sense, that's the easy bit. You know, you projecting something in a big way is, it's more obvious what you've got to do. What's less obvious is how to draw people in. But it is possible, I think, to shrink the Albert Hall.
It does have the most splendidly bombastic opening, though, doesn't it? When
yeah.
It's you and the orchestra, and it's huge and it's dramatic. Can you give us a little whirl?
Yeah, sure. There's something about the opening chord. You know, I'm a bit of a nerd. I actually get goose pimples just from hearing that first chord of the orchestra. I could just listen to those first two chords, actually.
We'd all be a little sorry if you stopped there.
Yes.
I've got to be honest, Paul, but...
Here's the piano making its statement at the beginning of the Emperor Concerto. So that's what sets the scene. This is the opening flourish. Then you have an enormous orchestral tutti, which sort of carries on in the same vein. But soon enough, you know, you get this second theme. You know, it's the opposite end of the scale. And when the piano plays that, all you have is strings, pizzicato, pianissimo. You have to hear it as well. So there's something very delicate about the balance here. And that's what I mean about this piece. The obvious face of it is what you hear at the start. But it's trying to integrate the many sides of it into the bigger picture and to make it feel as significant as what is immediately obvious about it.
Paul Lewis there speaking to me a little earlier, regarded before this season as one of the finest pianists of his generation, and his reputation has been nothing but enhanced by the performances we've heard so far of his Beethoven Concerto cycle this summer. Well, tonight's conductor, Stéphane Deneuve, is certainly a big fan.
It's actually not the first time, so I knew already that that would be something really incredible, because we already did together the second Beethoven Piano Concerto, and I was amazed how much this actually was what you can only dream about Beethoven. That's the obvious of his playing, which surprised me. You know, there's kind of no question. You kind of feel, why anybody could play that differently? Like, it's very strange. That's something which I found really amazing with him, is it's incredibly honest, it's incredibly obvious, and it's very, 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 very amazing way to use the piano, I think, in Beethoven. It does have a very special sound. As a conductor, I'm very near him, and I'm very lucky because I hear the greatest pianists of the world quite regularly, I have to say, and it's fascinating because he does have his own sound. The piano sounds Beethovenian just right away, and that's really special.
He certainly does think very highly of Paul Lewis's playing, and I think we all share that view. It's interesting to note that Beethoven wrote this piece, his fifth piano concerto, at a stage of his life when his hearing had not completely gone, and he probably, it's thought, hoped to play this concerto in public, but that never happened. Vienna was invaded by the French in 1809, just as he'd finished the piece. The city was then in turmoil for months, and the first known performance of the Fifth of the Emperor was given in Leipzig by the pianist Friedrich Schneider in November 1811. Well, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra are just about to tune up. You can hear the leader, James Clark, getting a round of applause there for playing an A on the piano. And they're preparing themselves for this performance by Paul Lewis. The first time, I should say, that all five Beethoven piano concertos have been played in one season in the entire history of the Proms. Quite the event. Paul has had an extremely busy summer, as you can imagine, getting ready for this. In 3 weeks of the summer, in fact, have been spent in Australia. He told me earlier he's about to take a well-earned holiday with his family, but then added that he's hired a piano to practice. When do pianists ever take a holiday? I'm not sure. Soon he's going to be launching a 2-year Schubert project, and of course it's worth mentioning as well that his complete Beethoven piano concertos with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jerzy Bielochlawek, have just been released. But here he comes now to the stage with conductor Stéphane Deneuve to perform the climax of his Beethoven piano concerto cycle at this year's Proms, the Fifth.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
applause says it all. Some nights at the proms are very special indeed, and tonight was one of those nights. Paul Lewis has completed his historic cycle of all Beethoven's piano concertos in a single prom season with that dazzling combination of delicacy, virtuosity, but power as well. Not for one second was his authority in question. Beethoven's fifth piano concerto in E-flat major, performed there by Paul Lewis for the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Stéphane Deneuve. The soloist, the conductor, coming back to the stage now to take more of these rapturous cheers from the crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall and from the orchestra too. Stéphane Deneuve, who's extremely expressive, theatrical style, drew that wonderfully sensitive, measured performance from the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. And he said to me earlier, in his typically colourful way, that the partnership between a conductor and a soloist, like Paul Lewis, was like lovers walking hand in hand. You may not know who is leading, but you always go in the right direction. And there was certainly a charming connection between the two men. Stéphane Deneuve sometimes almost leaning on the piano companionably, looking around at the musicians of the orchestra as if to say, oh, isn't it marvellous, before leaping back into action like a genial but slightly crazed ringmaster, conducting sometimes, it seemed, with his shock of crazy ginger hair. The stamping and the cheers there for Paul Lewis, this modest Liverpudlian. A quiet, very sweet-natured man. What a pianist, and what an achievement. The first time ever at the proms, all five Beethoven piano concertos. The audience don't want to let him go. They're both coming back to the stage, Stéphane Deneuve and Paul Lewis. And bringing the Royal Scottish National Orchestra to their feet once more. They played beautifully too, didn't they? Well, I think the audience have decided that it is time, perhaps, to let the orchestra take a break. It is time for the interval now. And during the interval, we are going to feature a short story here on BBC Radio 3 by the poet and novelist Sophie Hannah. Aptly, dusk approaches and a chilling set of circumstances emerge in The Visitor's Book.
I am not a snob. My parents are snobs. Every member of my family, apart from me, is a snob, and I am nothing like any of them. I do not, as my sister Lydia does, own a black cat with one paw that's white, that I've named Poor White Trash. Trash, for short. My mother commits the details of the Sunday Times rich list to memory. I don't. Alex is the snob. Not me. At the very least, he's a pretentious idiot. He's standing with his back to me, opening a bottle of wine. I shouldn't say anything. I should let it go. Except that after what I've just discovered about him, I want to have the row more than I want Alex as a boyfriend. I'm not a snob, I say. When we got out of the cab and I first saw his house, my reaction was entirely neutral. It was just a house. It only occurred to me in the light of what happened next that Alex's home is a two-up, two-down, back-to-back terrace on a street lined with similar houses, red brick on one side, white rendering dirty to grey on the other. Alex's is one of the red bricks. What else did I notice? Washing hanging on lines in small square front yards, net curtains to ward off nosy passers-by. Some clean cars, some dirty. One half-collapsed, missing its front two wheels. I didn't see Alex's house and think, oh dear, it's not a detached mansion. Why would I? I live in a tiny two-bedroom flat above a jeweller's shop. A snob is my least favourite sort of person, Alex says, as if he might not be talking about me. I'm not a snob, I insist. When I asked you to sign the visitor's book, you laughed as if it was the most hilarious thing in the world. He smiles and hands me a glass of wine. Tell me what you found so funny, and we'll see if there's an element of snobbery involved. He doesn't sound angry or offended. He sounds analytical, is the only way I can describe it. As if he's interested intellectually, but it doesn't matter to him. It makes me feel uneasy. I stare down at the large, green, leather-bound book that's spread open in front of me on the kitchen table. The visitor's book. That's what he called it. And that's what it appears to be. It has the words visitor's book on the cover in gold cursive writing. I flick through the pages, skimming the comments. Netterden is a fantastic house. We shall remember our visit with great fondness, the Flemings. We had such fun and will take away with us plenty of memories to treasure. Winifred and John Santandreu, Islington, London. The views from the terrace at dusk are breathtaking. Richard and Sue Graham. Different inks, different handwritings. Most are shaky and erratic, as if the writers were sloshed or too old and doddery to care. The book appears to be genuine. How utterly preposterous. You're telling me no one else has laughed at this, I say, wondering if I'm the only non-pretentious person in Alex's social circle.
Have you never signed a visitor's book before? He asks.
Yes, plenty. Some friends and I hired a manor house in Devon once to celebrate finishing our degrees. Wortham Manor. It was several hundred years old.
Exactly the sort of place where you'd expect to find a visitor's book. Alex cuts me off.
I also...
Go on.
My godmother is married to a lord. You know, in the House of Lords.
I didn't think you meant a lord in the heavens above.
His sense of humour was what first attracted me to him. They've got a visitor's book in their Hampshire mansion.
Which you signed without laughing.
Credit me with some manners.
Yet you laughed at me.
Alex, you don't live in a mansion or a historical manor house. Those are the sort of houses that have visitor's books. Your house just isn't. Look, is this a prank? Did you forge all these different handwritings yourself? And this is too ridiculous. I can't take it seriously.
You think I've got ideas above my station? You're wrong.
It's not about above or below. It's... He must be able to see it. Until 5 minutes ago, I thought he was sane and normal. It's about context. If I saw Prince Charles walking down the road wearing a baby grow, I'd laugh. Whereas I wouldn't laugh if I saw a baby wearing a baby grow. I don't think Prince Charles is worse or less deserving of a baby grow than a baby is. I'd laugh because it's a weird and surprising context in which to see a baby grow, just as a two-bedroom terraced house belonging to a 29-year-old inner-city secondary school history teacher is an unusual context for a visitor's book.
Mightn't a history teacher want to keep a record of the people who visit his home? For sentimental reasons? Alex asks, sipping his wine. Think about it. History.
It's the first good point he's made. For a second, I wonder if he's sensible and open-minded, and I'm a bigoted fool. Then I come to my senses. Netterden. One of those comments referred to the house as Netterden, whereas your front door seems to think it's called number 32.
So it's pretentious to give a house a name. This from the woman who buys a car with a number plate that ends LMO and immediately christens it Elmo.
That's different, I protest.
I bet your godmother's Hampshire mansion has a name, doesn't it? And you don't think there's anything wrong with that?
My godmother's house needs a name for the simple reason that it isn't on a street. They could hardly call it 27, the middle of a load of greenery, could they?
You can think of no hypothesis that would allow me to have a visitor's book in my house and not be absurdly pretentious. Then, like all snobs, you lack imagination.
I stand up. I'm going. Do you want to ring for the butler? Or shall I show myself out?
You're making a mistake, he says.
I slam the front door behind me and march down the street without looking back. I have no idea where I'm going, where the nearest bus stop or tube station is. My mind is full of jagged scraps of ideas that clash into one another, random and incoherent. A quote flashes in my brain. Last night I dreamt I went to Mandalay again. I laugh out loud. I am not crazy. Daphne du Maurier, who also wasn't crazy, knew when she wrote the first line of Rebecca that Mandalay had to be the name of a vast country estate. Would the novel have become a classic if Maxim de Winter had lived in a two-bed terrace in Walthamstow? No, it would not. Mrs. Danvers would have had to sleep in the second bedroom, a stone's throw from the first. She'd have heard her boss and his new wife having sex through the thin partition wall. Netterden. Did he call it that because the street's full of scuzzy neck curtains? All right. Perhaps I am a snob. I don't care if I am. Alex is the crazy one. Him and all his freakish friends who wrote those pompous comments. The Flemings. Winifred and John Santandreur from Islington, London. I stop walking as a chilly fear seeps through me, pinning me to the spot. Islington, London. Walthamstow is also in London. Why wouldn't the Santandreurs simply have written Islington? Surely you wouldn't write Islington, London, unless you were writing in the visitor's book of a house that was outside London. And there's something else, something I can't put my finger on that's not quite right. It's like a shadow snagging at the back of my mind. What is it? I turn round to check Alex isn't following me. He isn't. It's safe to stand here and allow myself to work it out. Safe? Since when have I been scared of him? I try to remember other entries I read. There was one from Richard and Sue something or other. Richard and Sue Graham. The views from the terrace at dusk are breathtaking. No, it's all wrong. No one would say that about a terraced house. No one would call it the terrace. I am sure of this. Not Richard and Sue Graham, not anybody. They might say the views from the house at dusk are breathtaking. Except they aren't. It's round about dusk now. Not quite dark yet, but not light either. Isn't that what dusk means? Why didn't this occur to me before, when I first read those words? I was too busy skimming the pages for evidence of Alex's pretentiousness. I must have seen the word terrace and thought that since Alex's house is a terrace... I feel sick, shaky. I'm certain those words weren't written about the house I've just left, the view from which, at dusk or any other time, is of a row of dirty white houses on an unremarkable, some might say shabby, street. True, I didn't look out of any of the back windows. But Alex lives in Walthamstow, for goodness sake. How breathtaking can the view from the back bedroom possibly be? There's nothing for miles around but rows of terraced houses on treeless streets. Richard and Sue Graham can't have been writing about Alex's home. Wherever and whatever Netterden is, it isn't a terrace. It has a terrace. Perhaps with a stone balustrade. Certainly with a fantastic view of the grounds, where people might sit and sip champagne cocktails as the sun goes down. At dusk. Why didn't Alex tell me the truth? And if Netterden isn't his house, what's he doing with its visitor's book? Why did he show it to me? I close my eyes, try to picture what happened. The book was on the kitchen table when we walked in. I said, "What's this?" as I sat down. He didn't draw it to my attention. I noticed it and asked about it. Maybe he'd been looking at it earlier, before he came out to meet me. And in his rush to leave the house, he forgot to put it away. He very quickly called me a snob when I laughed. Before I had time to focus on how odd it was, how the comments couldn't have been referring to the house I was in. He was gambling on being able to distract me, make me focus, instead of defending myself. I still can't summon the not-quite-right detail, the snag at the back of my mind. Perhaps it will come to me. Thinking about it, Alex never said his house was called Netterden. He was more careful, more precise. He said, "So it's pretentious to give a house a name," and asked if I couldn't think of another hypothesis to explain his having a visitor's book. He must have stolen it from the real Netterden. If it was in his possession for a legitimate reason, why not say so? How far am I from a library? I've no idea, and I'm not calm enough to set about finding out. I pull my mobile out of my bag and ring directory inquiries. When a woman answers, I ask for St. Andrew in Islington. I have to spell the name twice.
"I've got a Winifred St. Andrew on Gladsmere Road, Islington," says the woman.
It must be her. How many Winifred St. Andrews can there be in London? I ask to be connected. A few seconds later, a man's voice says,
"Hello, Michael St. Andrew speaking."
"May I speak to Winifred? Or John?"
"My parents passed on in January 2006. Who are you?"
"My name's Francesca Wooden Blake. Look, I'm sorry, I'll leave you alone. It's not important." They both died in January 2006. I can't decide if it's odd. Perhaps I'm the odd one.
"What did you want?"
asks Michael St. Andrew. It's not important. Why did I say that?
"I might be able to help you with whatever it is."
I was going to ask them if they remembered visiting a house called Netterden, but, as I said, it's really not...
"Netterden."
He throws the word at me like a stone. "What?"
"That's where my parents were when they died."
"Pardon?" The world tips on its axis.
"It's one of Gloucestershire's oldest houses. I think the Landmark Trust owns it now. It used to belong to Penny and Clive Hoddy. That's where my parents died, at one of Penny and Clive's parties. Look, if you don't know what happened in January 2006, why are you asking about Netterden?"
Alex's surname is Penny. His middle name is Clive. I teased him about it on our first date. I hold onto a wall to steady myself. "Please, just tell me. I can explain why I want to know. But don't ask me to explain now," I silently plead with him.
23 people died that night. Everybody there. My uncle and aunt, too. Sarah and Peter Fleming. The Flemings. I know, without needing to be told, that Richard and Sue Graham are also dead. There were no dates in the visitor's book. None. That's the detail that was bothering me, the one I couldn't call to mind. People who sign visitor's books always write the date. Unless they're doing it at gunpoint, all on the same day, their last day. What does the date matter if you're about to die? I think about the shaky handwriting and about how terror would make a person's hand shake more than alcohol or old age. But the comments they wrote, were they forced to come up with the wording themselves? Did they have their entries dictated to them? I can't bear to think about it.
You haven't. Michael Santandre clears his throat. You didn't hear about it on the news.
I don't watch the news or read the papers. What happened? I ask. It's all I can do to hold myself upright.
Somebody, or should I say two people, shot them all. All the guests. Penny and Clive, their daughter Eleanor. I'm sorry, there's no nice way of putting it. The cleaner found the bodies the following Monday morning. Purses, wallets and bags missing. Most of them had pens in their hands. I've no idea why. And the police still don't have a clue what it might mean. In a way, that remains the biggest mystery.
Who? I start to ask, though I know the answer. Two people. Who was the other one?
Penny and Clive's two sons were and still are the only suspects. They disappeared that night and haven't surfaced since. There was no break-in, you see.
Pens in their hands.
Thomas and Alex. I met them once or twice. There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that they did it.
There's no doubt in mine either. But in my panic, I can't help saying, it might have been anyone.
No. Those two weren't right in the head. They hated their family, thought their parents were appalling snobs. No doubt they thought mine were too, and all the other guests at Netterden that night, says Michael.
I hear a noise behind me. I turn, see Alex walking towards me, smiling. It is still light enough for me to see his face. Still dusk. He is holding a pen in one hand, the visitor's book in the other.
Fenella Woolgar was reading The Visitor's Book by Sophie Hannah. It was first broadcast last September, and the producer was Duncan Minshall. But welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall here on Radio 3. I'm Katie Derham, and you can hear the Prommers telling us about how much money they've raised for charity. Don't forget, you can listen again to this particular prom, and you probably would like to after that performance from Paul Lewis in the first half, by going to the website for the next 7 days. That's bbc.co.uk/radio3. If you'd like to read the programme notes, they're there on the proms website, so bbc.co.uk/proms. And I should also tell you, you can hear this particular prom and all the proms for the rest of the season in extra high quality audio stream if you go via your computer. So check out the website for information about that and tell us what you think. But here we are. It has been a fabulous night so far, but we have another packed half to go. Next, we have a piece which is receiving its London premiere tonight by James McMillan, acknowledged as one of our leading living composers. And the piece is a series of three orchestral interludes taken from his recent opera, The Sacrifice. The opera was first performed just 3 years ago. It had stellar reviews, including one from tonight's conductor, when I asked him about the work earlier.
Well, this was a big shock when I heard it for the first time, because it grabs you from the start. I mean, the opening is as strong, I would say, as the opening of Electra of Strauss, for instance. It's just bursting, it's just incredible. And then right away, I'm always amazed by the character of his melodies, because there are melodies. I can really sing the piece from A to Z. And I found that fascinating, that he does something new, unique, which is really music of our time, but he knows how to create those incredible tunes, I would say. And he used the orchestra also in a very specific way. It's kind of tribal. It's very dark. It's very rhythmical. And I have to say, the first time I heard it, I was really impressed by it. And I wanted to hear it again. And that would sound a bit strange to that, but I'm not listening a lot of music. I mean, I usually only listen to music to document myself. You know, when I'm studying a piece, I just want to check what the history of the tradition has been, or, you know, to just hear different possibilities. But it's really like a documentation. And this piece of Macmillan is one of the very rare pieces that actually I desire to listen for my own pleasure. And I surprise myself sometimes to say, oh, let's listen to it again. And I find it very touching. And then I discover the opera. And the opera is incredible, I have to say. This is a very, very strong, very dark story. And it's very strange, because when we meet James Macmillan, he's so sweet. He's such a nice man. He speaks always very softly. And he's like a wonderful, you know, Scottish teddy bear. And then he writes the most incredibly violent and dark music. But I'm very sensitive to that drama, and it's a great opportunity for an interpreter to really express a great dramatic, theatrical way of making music.
Stéphane Deneuve talking to me earlier, and it really is pretty powerful stuff. A tale of forbidden love between rival clans. It ends with a supreme act of self-sacrifice. It's based on a collection of ancient Welsh myths. The three interludes are called The Parting, when the two lovers split before a wedding which will bring the two warring clans together, but which causes them heartbreak. And then there's the Paschalia, the wedding feast, which will end in violence. And then the Investiture, set 7 years later, when the young son of the married couple will be crowned as a symbol of clan unity. Well, it doesn't end well. The scene ends with the murder of the boy by the still heartbroken lover. Well, it's going to be performed by the orchestra playing tonight, the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, and it will be conducted by the man coming to the stage right now, who you just heard there, speaking about this piece, Stéphane Deneuve. That was three interludes from James Macmillan's The Sacrifice, performed there by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and conducted by Stéphane Deneuve, who was just applauding the score. I wonder if James Macmillan is in the audience. I think he may well be. That was the London premiere of that piece. Orchestral interludes from the opera The Sacrifice, a very dark piece, but a very dramatic one, and one I know that Stéphane Deneuve thoroughly enjoys. James Macmillan, for 9 years, the composer and conductor with the BBC Philharmonic, and this year has become the principal guest conductor of the Netherlands Radio Chamber Philharmonic. And his anthem, To My Successor, was featured at the enthronement of Rowan Williams as Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's now written a setting of the new English translation of the Mass for the visit of Pope Benedict XVI later this month. But from that dark drama of The Sacrifice to something altogether more cheerful, Respighi's Pines of Rome. Respighi, an Italian composer at the start of the 20th century, who's best known for his trilogy of pieces about Rome. The adjective most frequently used to describe his music is colourful, and Stéphane Deneuve is no exception.
Well, it's wonderful because that's the nearest you get to be a painter. And unfortunately, I paint very badly. My little baby would tell you that. She's 2.5 and she already paints better than me. But when I'm conducting this kind of music, the impressionist music, of course, of France, but also this Respighi, I really feel I can try to create spaces, and I really feel I'm putting a lot of different colors. And this is, of course, a very, very well-known piece, one of the most incredible climax ever written. I mean, the end of it is out of this world, I mean, really. But there is also a lot of poetry in it, and I really like to try to find a lot of images, and when I'm rehearsing with the orchestra, I have a whole scenario, I have to say, and I bother them a lot, telling them, you know, what I imagine and all the little anecdotes that I could see happening in this piece. But indeed, it's also quite dramatic. There is also a lot of theatrical effects, and it's just very rich, lush music.
Stéphane Deneuve speaking to me earlier about this piece, Respighi's Pines of Rome. So, it is a musical depiction of life in Rome in the 1920s, and it's inspired by the pine trees which grow throughout the city, and specifically in this case around his villa. He paints a picture of four places in Rome at different times of day or night. First, we have the pines of the Villa Borghese, where children are at play. Then we have pines near a catacomb, cue mournful psalm singing. And then the pines of the Janiculum Hill, a slow movement set at dawn. And then finally, the pines of the Via Appia, which was, of course, the great military highway of classical Rome, hence the most fabulously over-the-top march to the climax, as Stefan de Neve was saying earlier. Well, the stage here has filled up. I don't think there's any space left. It is a huge orchestra for this work. People have emerged from all sorts of corners to augment the brass section. We have an organist, we have more percussion, a lot more percussion. And we await now the return to the stage of Stefan de Neve to conduct the Royal Scottish National Orchestra in Respighi's Pines of Rome. Here he is.
Thank you.
Well, we promised you a big finish. And I think Stefan Denev and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra delivered that. The final section there, the Via Appia from Respighi's Pines of Rome. What a noise. Organist Michael Bawtry there coming into his own at the end. It's his birthday today. Happy birthday, Michael. Stefan Denev making his way through to the wind section to personally shake soloists by the hand. He's been the musical director of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra for the last 5 years, and it's clearly a partnership that suits all parties very well indeed. The core Anglais player Zoe Kitson being brought to her feet, many soloists now receiving the applause of the crowd here. The musical establishment in the past were rather snobby about Respighi. They said he wrote film music. But as Stefan Denev said to me earlier, he said, "And what on earth is wrong with that?" An extremely popular end to a very successful prom. What an evening. That last piece, Respighi's Pines of Rome, one of a trilogy. I'll be playing The Fountains of Rome, one of the other pieces in the trilogy, in a couple of weeks' time on Afternoon on Three. That's on Monday the 20th of September. I do hope you will join me then for more Roman frolics. Stefan Denev taking another bow there. A very charismatic, theatrical conductor. Great presence on the podium. He comes from the school of full body conducting, from the tips of his toes to every one of his extraordinary ginger hairs. I think on that note, though, it's time for me to say goodbye. Do stay tuned, though, as at 10 o'clock we have a late night prom, which of course you can listen to live here on Radio 3, featuring the ensemble Matthäus, playing Baroque music by Handel, Vivaldi, Telemann. Time, though, now to hand you back to Broadcasting House, to my colleague John Shea.
Thank you, Katie. That was Katie Derham live at the Royal Albert Hall. And as ever, you can listen again to tonight's first concert, online via the Radio 3 homepage. Nothing wrong with a bit of Respighi, quite right. And while you're about it, why not submit your own review of the concert? You can do that via the Proms website. They're all linked to each other, bbc.co.uk/radio3 or for bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, Katie has just told us about the later prom tomorrow night. The prom later tonight. Here's Susie Klein now to look ahead to tomorrow evening.
The proms continue on BBC Radio 3 as Daniele Gatti comes to the festival with the Orchestre National de France. They'll be performing three of the great works of the turn of the last century, Debussy's Prélude à l'après-midi d'un faune, arguably the moment that modern music started. There's also La Mer, his immense, stirring love letter to the sea, and also Stravinsky's explosive Rite of Spring. All three pieces completely different from each other and written within just 20 years of each other. Join me, Susie Klein, as the proms continue tomorrow at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this evening on Radio 3, and our next programme in 5 minutes or so is the Lebrecht interview. This week, Norman is in conversation with Patrice Chéreau, director of film, theatre and opera. That's at 9:15. And then, as you've just heard, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's late prom of Handel, Vivaldi and Telemann. That's given by Ensemble Matthäus and their director Jean-Christophe Spinozzi. That's at 10 o'clock. So, before the Lebrecht interview, something unusual that I've just found while rummaging through Rob Cowan's collection of CDs outside in the corridor. This is a disc issued last year on which the Wihan Quartet play the 24 caprices of Paganini, music originally for solo violin, of course, but arranged here by William Zinn, who's been a member of several leading American orchestras. And this is his version of the Caprice No. 11. From Paganini's famous set of 24 caprices, that was number 11 in C major, arranged by William Zinn for string quartet and played there by the Wihan Quartet. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's 9:15 now, and time for the final programme in this summer's series of the Lebrecht interview. And tonight's programme contains strong language. Here's Norman Lebrecht.
Patrice Chéreau is responsible for what many regard as the defining opera production of modern times. In 1976, he went to Bayreuth with Pierre Boulez to reinvent Richard Wagner's Ring cycle for its 100th anniversary, and in doing so, forced the world to look afresh at one of the cornerstones of musical civilization. It was not just the staging of the saga that caused eyebrows to shoot up. It was the adaptation of that production as a television serial in 10 parts that brought The Ring into our living rooms and our lives as a living, gripping parable of the things people do when they are tempted by power and wealth. Every politician should be required to watch the set before taking office. Chéreau was not Bayreuth's first choice, but his Ring made the widest ripples of any to emerge from the Wagner shrine. Although he's created other important opera productions, he's not primarily an opera director. In France, he's known as a theatrical powerhouse whose achievements are bracketed with those of Peter Brook and Jean-Louis Barrault. He's also a filmmaker of such delicate and dangerous works as Intimacy and Persecution. Although a fluent English speaker, he's never worked in Britain, though that's about to change. A young-looking 65, he lives in the old Marais district of Paris, where we meet on a summer's day. Patrice Chéreau, it comes as something of a shock to someone who was smitten by your brave, new, modern Ring to read that your favourite music is Mozart.
I think probably my favourite music is Wagner. I like Mozart, but I have a huge difficulty in making production from Mozart. I try to make Don Giovanni, I try to make Così fan tutte, which was a little more successful, but this is extremely difficult. In other words, extremely difficult with this music to make my job, to direct, to tell a story, to invent, to propose a psychological logic from the characters. And
because it's so remote from our time? Because you're such a contemporary person?
No, because I think with Wagner, the rules of the opera changes. People who are doing opera, the composers, stop writing recitative and then aria, and an aria is an introduction and then has a coda, and then or the ensemble, quartet, sextet, and so on and so on, which is difficult, extremely interesting formally to try to follow, but extremely difficult to put on stage. So Wagner went back to the theatre. He went back to the sources of the theatre, to the Greek tragedy, to Shakespeare. So he read very, very well all the tragedy by Shakespeare. In Wotan, Brunhilde, you have King Lear, if you want. You have also Antigone. You have also the Greeks. So Wagner allows me to make really my métier, my job, to make really theatre.
So Wagner for you is theatre before it is opera?
It's both. As many, many conductors say, opera should be theatre also, because if it's not theatre, it's rather better to make a concert, you know. But if you are going on stage, it's just because the mean of the stage should tell really a story who can be told only on stage and not anywhere else. So Now, Wagner is really theatre. He forces me to make theatre. He forces me to find its psychological depth in all the characters. It forces me to find the structure of the story and the contradiction. He forces me to show life and real life and death and love in on stage.
Which came first in your life, music or theatre?
I started with the theatre. Wanted always to make theatre on stage and also to make
even
films.
Even as a small boy?
As a small boy, yes. I wanted to make theatre, I wanted to be director. As soon as I understood what happens in theatre, that only somebody was there just to organise everything, not to be the chief, but just to organise and to tell the story, I wanted to be this guy.
But how did you know about theatre? You were born in this very small town, Lézigné, in western France. Population today is 709.
It was because of the war, because my parents and my grandparents were not refugees, but they couldn't stay in Paris. It was easier for having children to find food at the countryside and not in Paris. But then immediately after the war...
You were born in the year of liberation, 1944.
44, yes. Mm-hmm. But immediately, I think two or three years later, we were in Paris. We had a beautiful apartment in Rue de Seine. So I was always in Paris. And also my family was, they were artists. You know, my father was painter and my mother as well. So I grew up in an apartment a little like this one, big, and where there were a lot of tables, a lot of pens, a lot of pencil, a lot of brushes and colors and canvas and everything. So it was, that was my environment. And I was drawing at the beginning. I was starting making drawings and making paintings. But then very quick, I turned toward the theater. I don't know why. Theater and films. The opera came later, when suddenly I started to be a little, not famous, but a little better known. People asked me to make a production in Spoleto, in Italy.
And films, as a boy, you were going to the cinema?
I was going a lot to the cinema. Mm. I was going to the Cinémathèque Française, which was 100 metres from the high school I was, mm-hmm. so I could make both.
What left the biggest impression on you? Which films were...
Oh, the German Expressionism.
Really?
I think the film by Fritz Lang, M. You know, I saw it when I was 13, 14. I saw it 14 times. I think I know it by memory. German Expressionism, I remember very well. The silent movies and Orson Welles. And of course, Orson Welles make a huge impression because he came from the theatre as well. So that's why immediately I made a connection in my mind. I made a connection between theatre and cinema. And I thought immediately that I could do both.
And which Orson Welles in particular?
Citizen Kane, of course.
Citizen Kane.
The beautiful one, The Splendour of the Amberson. And Confidential Report, which is a brilliant film.
What kind of upbringing did you have? Was it a religious upbringing or a free thinking?
Well, it was a strange environment because I grew up in the Catholicism. My mother was a believer and my father don't. My father was atheist, totally. So there was a tension at home with the two possibilities.
And politically, were they of the left?
Politically, I think I make my own education because when I was 16, it was just the time of the Algerian war, War of Algeria. So at that time, it was easy, I must say. You had to take a position. You had to decide, were you on the side of the French Algeria or do you want the peace in Algeria? What about my case? When I was 16 or 17, I make demonstration in the street and I went to the jail for one night or for two nights. Even with a Greek dictionary, I remember, because I went from the school. And that was a beautiful time, I must say. 61, 62. Terrible, because it was very tough, very violent. Mm. Very violent in Paris itself, but very interesting. And that from there came my formation.
Yeah. And then de Gaulle restores order and you complete your upbringing under this really very strong regime. Were you an opponent or were you...?
I was an opponent, yes. We were happy that de Gaulle had give the independence to the Algeria. It was the only solution anyway. But then I was an opponent, yes. Because suddenly, after Algeria, we discovered that we were really on a right regime. And that was awful until 68. It was very tough.
Several of your films are about skewed family relationships, many of them with gay themes. As early as 1983, in L'Homme Blessé, you deal with a young man coming out. In Son Frère, there were two brothers. Was this a way of working through things that were coming through in your adolescence, of working through things that perhaps you couldn't discuss with your family?
You don't discuss, you never discuss those kind of things in the family, you know. You leave the things, in that case the homosexuality, but you don't discuss that. L'Homme Blessé had a lot to do with my adolescence, you know, a lot to do with my sexuality and what I discovered when I was 19, 20, and I wanted to speak of that. It was a time I wasn't happy with the two previous films I did, so I thought suddenly I felt necessary for the third, I needed to speak about myself. I needed to be closer of my truth. So that's where the L'Homme Blessé come from. And I remember in San Francisco when I introduced the film, I have a lot of problem with the homosexual community sometimes. With L'Homme Blessé, they were really angry against the film. And
why?
Because it was sad, because it was a mix of combination of homosexuality and unhappiness. And they didn't like that at that time. After that, it was impossible to talk because there came AIDS in 1981-82. But then at that time, it was difficult.
When you came into theatre, was it as an actor or as a director?
I never wanted to be an actor. I wasn't interested. I played myself in my production, of course, because for the lack of people, you know. You should do something, you should do everything, also acting. But I was never interested in acting. I wanted always to be the one who was organizing everything. That was my intention, that was my interest.
At 20 years old, you put on your first college play, Victor Hugo, yeah. Intervention.
A very bad play, a terrible play.
Why did you do Hugo? It's the 1960s.
Because when you are 20 years old, you are always interested in presenting something that nobody did before, you know? So the totally unknown play by Victor Hugo that never wanted to do for good reasons, because it's not very good. You said, I want to do that, you know? But it's very typical for the young people. It's very typical from the kind of artificial knowledge you get in the high school, you said, you know? I will discover an unknown play by Victor Hugo, but it was not very good.
And yes. Did you think it was important for a young director to start with the classics, with Hugo, with Chekhov, with Shakespeare?
I never asked the question. I thought I will do it, and then I did it. The important thing at that time was to make something. I started with Victor Hugo, then I started... The next one was Lope de Vega, I think, and the third one was Marivaux. Obviously, I wasn't going towards the contemporary repertory. Mm-hmm. It took a long, long time for me to work with living writers. A long, long time. I don't know why. It was a mistake, obviously.
Was there a discipline that you got from the classics or a sense of security?
Yes, probably. It's always that, you know. Mm. It's always that, and you said, well, I will show something that nobody have seen in that play, and I will give my own reading of this play. But then you discover, long time later, you discover that in reality the real risk and the real interest is to going towards writer who has the same age as you and who describe the world you are living.
From the age of 22, you were running theatres in Sartrouville,
yes.
Lyon, Paris, from 1982 to Nanterre. Was that idea of being an administrator the best way of getting what you want?
Yes, not only. You know, I think it's a moment in the life where it's important to decide yourself and to produce yourself what you are doing. That, in other words, when I'm doing a production, also when I'm doing a film, I'd rather be the one who says, is too expensive, you have to cut, rather to wait that somebody says, I don't give you the money, we don't have enough money. So I think if you decide yourself, your budget, and how you can reduce, because the costs are always too big, you become a bigger freedom, I think, artistic freedom. The artistic freedom is when you manage and you are really, you have in your hands all the budget and you can decide where you should put the money. So I was interested in knowing that. But in Sartrouville, I learned a lot because I make bankruptcy. I was 25.
You were actually bankrupt? You were.
I was bankrupt because at that time it was a company in my own name. So I was responsible of the debt and the benefits, of course.
And what actually happened on the day you went bust?
I went to work in Italy and I stopped to work in France. And I paid. I paid the old debts for 20 years. It was quite big. But I paid and then I went to work in Italy because they asked me to work. And then the second theatre I directed was together with Roger Planchon. So I wasn't responsible of anything. It was his own theatre and I was a guest. Where I learned is the third one, is Nanterre. Mm. That was really an interesting moment, a really interesting and not obvious project, a totally different project. And that was very good. 82, 90, I think. But good enough and interesting enough to say also, I don't want to direct anything now.
In Italy, you did Shakespeare in Milano, followed by Wedekind's Lulu, and then Rossini at the Spoleto.
Oh, Rossini was my first opera. It was also my first job in Italy. It was strange what I did, honestly. It was my first opera as well.
Yes.
So my first contact with an opera, with a conductor, was very interesting but very capricious. But, well, I loved it, making operas.
So the first opera that you staged was also the first one that you saw?
Maybe. I don't remember exactly.
And then the second one is at the Opéra de Paris.
Yes.
It's Tales of Hoffmann.
Tales of Hoffmann, yeah.
And then you get the call to go to Bayreuth.
Yes, exactly. My third production. As you told before, I wasn't the first choice.
No.
I made it only because the previous one were...
Turned it down.
Or they were fired, like Peter Stein.
Well, Ingmar Bergman turned it down, Peter Brook turned it down, Peter Stein was fired.
Peter Stein was fired because he wanted to cut. So, which was impossible. And then he said to Wolfgang Wagner that I want to denazify Bayreuth. But with right or not, Wolfgang Wagner had the impression that he never stopped doing that already. He did it already, which is true, with his brother. So it stopped. But it was strange.
Tell me exactly how this came about. Where were you when you got the call?
I got the call by Pierre Boulez.
Right.
Bayreuth agrees that Pierre Boulez should choose the director.
Right.
So Pierre Boulez asked Ingmar Bergman, Peter Brook, and maybe Strehler, I don't know anymore, and Peter Stein. And Peter Stein was the choice. And then, from my point of view, I received a phone call from the secretary by Pierre Boulez, and the girl and the reception of the theatre didn't understand well, and she told me that it was a proposition for making the festival in Beirut, of course. Usual mistake, you know? And I said immediately, I don't want to go to Lebanon. I'm not interested. But because it was Pierre Boulez, I called back. And I met him, and we decided to go to Bayreuth. Finally, I understood my mistake, and I tried to work. And suddenly, I was ready. It was 74, 2 years before. I said yes, obviously. And we were starting to work. And then I make a film, my first film. And then I make the Tales of Hoffmann. And I receive a phone call or a letter from Wolfgang Wagner saying to me that finally he will do The Ring himself in 76, but he could offer me Lohengrin in 77. I said no. And then, in the meantime, they said no to me because Peter Stein came back and says, okay, I won't cut, I want to do The Ring. So they said to me, it's not for you. And then that they fought again between Peter Stein and Wolfgang Wagner. And in January or February or March, even, 75, they asked me again to do it. And I was almost at the point to say no, because it was too late. It was a year before, and I was stopping working. But then I wrote a letter to Pierre Boulez saying, I cannot not accept the ring, it's too late now. I don't have time. And at that time, there was no email, no faxes even, no cell phones. So I was about to send the letter. And I didn't put the letter. I said, wait a minute. Think about a little more. And then I said yes. That's how I did the ring. Anyway, Wolfgang Wagner asked me how many weeks of rehearsal I wish. And I said, well, 3 months. I said, okay. And I did the whole ring in 3 months. I could say more, but I didn't know at that time. That means that after 2 months and a half came the first dress rehearsal. I remember it was 14th of July, so I couldn't forget that suddenly after 2 months and a half it should be finished, and it was.
And you worked with Richard Peduzzi,
yeah,
who's your regular designer. You chose, yes, him, you brought him along.
Yes.
Before you set out for Bayreuth, did you have a clear idea of what you were going to do?
No. I remember Wagner asked me to write a few pages about a concept, as the German says, of what I wanted. I said, I remember that I told him that the water should be water, the forest should be with trees, the midget should be midgets, and the giant should be giants. To take seriously and concretely and figuratively all the elements of the ring and to describe them and to show them. And after that came in what time we should set this story, and we decided, because it was a memory of the Gattopardo, the film by Visconti, you know. We make the connection between Burt Lancaster and Wotan, which wasn't bad, but Burt Lancaster had a terrific look and a beautiful person and beautiful something what I can call a god, the idea you can have from a god. And we decided very, very soon to forget anything which could be timeless, you know. We wanted to describe the time by Wagner, 19th century, beginning of the industry, beginning of the idea of the revolution. Wagner wrote The Twilight of the Gods, the libretto, in 1848. So we tried to find the sources, to go back to the sources of the opera, and to find how to tell a mythological story. Mm-hmm. What could be our mythology? And mythology of mythology in the 19th century. That's it. We decided also to make, with Richard Peduzzi and my costume designer, Jacques Schmidt, to make also like a revival of all my previous production in theater. That's why we decided that Gunther and Gutrune should be in black dress and black tie, because it was a memory from La Dispute, from Marivaux, I made 2 or 3 years before. We decided also to dress in white Siegmund and Sieglinde in the first act. That was also a memory from La Dispute.
So at the age of 30, you're doing your own retrospective?
Yes, a little, because I try to find, you know, when you have just 1 year to destroy, you try to catch something from your own found, you know, from your old fundus, you know. Only that.
What did you mean by setting Goethe Dämmerung in what looked like New York?
It was a time where we discovered New York. And the time when you discover New York, you want to put New York everywhere. And when you arrive for the first time in your life in New York, you discover that it's really the center of the world. That's really, the architecture is so incredible, so powerful, and the mixture of the people are so incredible that it is the center, really, of the world. And it was that world that interested me. And I think also that is that world who could be destroyed, you know.
Was there any resistance from the singers to the novelty of your approach?
Only one was really almost a Nazi. Was called Karl Ritterbusch. But he was so fascinated by the violence that he loved this production a lot. He was so happy to kill Siegfried. He was so happy making Hunding, to kill Siegmund, you know? Siegmund is killed in my production, I remember, from one side by Wotan and the second other side by Hunding, both, with a spear. Suddenly the spectator was so angry in the first year that somebody near the husband, the Gwyneth Jones husband, screams suddenly at that place, typically French. This typisch Französisch. And Riederbusch was so happy of making that. He hated the costumes, and he told me something. Now it is nice, 30 or 35 years later, that he told me, with normal set, as a normal costume, you would have a hit. You would have a huge success with that.
Boulez had problems.
Boulez
had problems. The orchestra threatened to strike because he was making them play too soft.
Yes, Boulez had problems. And between the people, the musician who didn't want to come back, and the people that Pierre didn't want anymore, Wagner should change the half of the orchestra. 75 people in the second year. He went to Prague, who was still communist, and he hired the whole orchestra of the radio, and they went. It was incredibly clever. He said, well, okay. I must say, the problem of Boulez was to be obeyed by the orchestra, you know. They had at that time very bad habits, you know, to start the crescendo too soon, to make the fortissimo too loud, to never make any nuance, any pianissimi. Well, he has to change everything. That was hard. For me, it wasn't that hard. I had with me all the singers, really, everybody. The only difficult time was that I didn't have time enough for making everything. And in the last week, I should do one new scene every day because it was not finished. I make the first act of Valkyria in 3 days. I make the second act of Valkyria in 4 days. I never change for 5 years. I make Rheingold, the whole Rheingold, in 12 days, I remember. And it was finished. It was over. But then the difficulty came when you had the third act of Valkyria, the third act of Siegfried. The whole Siegfried was a mess. Because you don't know what to do, because the 1 hour is on his own in the forest and is a little boring, I must say. And then Twilight of the Gods, suddenly you have the chorus. But it's only, what, 60 minutes, so... When the premiere came, the battle for me was over. It was behind me.
The response from the Bayreuth audience was pretty hostile. Hissing, booing... And the press was pretty bad.
I wasn't that impressed. I was impressed only when I received a death threat.
From?
From an anonymous person who sent a letter from London who said, if you appear in front of the curtain on the day, and so, giving me the date, you will be shot. So I make the applause with the police in the wings at that day. The main thing was... The press conference, the first press conference, the next morning after the first Götterdämmerung, the first question was, will this ring come back next year? And the first answer from Wagner, Wolfgang Wagner, was yes. And he put his hand off my shoulder and he said, my friends, Patrice Giraud and Pierre Boulez, will do that next year again. And that was very brave from him, incredibly brave. Because in this climate, in this situation we were, everybody would be very happy if the answer was, okay, thank you, I will bring my old ring again back on stage and we stop. Everybody was hoping that, to stop the production.
Can you describe how you felt at that time? Were you frightened? Were you exhilarated? Were you challenged? You're quite young, and you're getting a really, for the first time, a really violent response from the public.
Yeah.
Was that a kind of confirmation that you were doing something right? Or did you feel embattled?
You know, the audience of every opera are always extreme. So we are not in the normal life. We are in the opera, so the people are screaming and shouting. I was getting used to be whistled anyway. I was whistled in my first production in Paris. Richard II by Shakespeare, I was whistled. The people were shouting. So I was getting used to it. But the challenge for me was to accomplish the whole thing. If the people tells me that the first act of Valkyria was shit, I was quite calm, because I think it was very good. If they tell me the first year that the third act of Valkyria was bad, I could agree, because it was bad. So it depends. If somebody tells me, you didn't do anything, make anything with Brünnhilde and Siegfried and the third act of Siegfried, I said, yes, you are right. But if they tell me the whole project was wrong, so in other words, after that I knew exactly what was right and what was wrong, what should be done again, what should be made totally new again. And
so it remained a work in progress,
yes,
until you were finally ready to film it.
And then 79 was different as the fourth year and the fifth year. Of course, it was where we make the TV, but it was different because we have lost René Collot, who was a beautiful Siegfried. We lost Zoltán Kelemen, who was a beautiful Alberich, and also Riederbusch, who stops. But the third year was beautiful. The third year was heaven, really. Good production, good lighting, good acting, very good acting.
In Britain, the cycle was shown on 10 Sunday afternoons on BBC Two.
Yeah.
And people stayed at home to watch it. Someone called it the operatic version of Upstairs, Downstairs, which was an Edwardian costume drama, massively popular. And for many viewers, it was their first exposure to Wagner. And by the final episodes, the audience was about 1 million every Sunday. You were actually making popular art.
Well, in a way, I don't know.
And at the same time, you were creating a work by which practically every opera that has been done since has been measured against. This is the beginning of the modern age.
Yes, I know. I couldn't think about that. I couldn't imagine, you know, and I didn't imagine. I was happy because I was happy in the first year, afraid, scared, terrified, but I was happy because I was happy with the material, with the story, and I knew that I could do it. But then I was thrilled by Wagner, you know. But then I couldn't imagine that what the posterity will do with my production.
Did you ever go back to Bayreuth? Did they ever ask you back?
They asked me, I never did. The first proposition I received by Daniel Barenboim was to make Tristan in 81. And after 5 years of The Ring, I said, no, I don't want to go back for five summer more. So I said, no. But then we did the Tristan in La Scala. And then they asked me to make Tristan again in 93. And I said again, no. It was also with Daniel Barenboim. And Pierre Boulez asked me in 2004 to make Parsifal. But I don't understand anything about Parsifal, so I cannot do it. The music is fantastic, of course, but I don't know what to do. So I will never do Parsifal. And I think after The Ring, I shouldn't come back to Bayreuth.
It would be easy to spend the rest of our time talking about Wagner, but the next opera you did was almost as momentous as The Ring. It was the world premiere of the complete version of Lulu,
yeah,
1979, a completion that had been suppressed since the death of its composer, Alban Berg. You'd done Wedekind before.
Yeah.
What did Lulu mean to you?
It's a beautiful play. It's a beautiful play. It's a play who has a lot to do with the German Expressionism, you know. I did the theatrical version in Milan, and I was very happy with it. And it's a kind of theatre I was happy with.
Do you believe in the character?
Yeah, totally.
I've never been able to work out who Lulu is.
I think she's a mirror. She's something quite passive, where the desire of the men could be attracted. And I remember only that I was saying at that time that people are killing themselves for her in the play. And I said, no, it's wrong. She attracts people who are interested in suicide, which is different. She doesn't want anything. She accepts everything from the men. It's not a femme fatale, you know. She's something coming from the street who has a total devotion, total dedication to one man, Dr. Schön. If you don't understand that, it's useless to do the play or to do the opera. When you see the Lulu von Pabst in the film, it's very beautiful because Louise Brooks is fantastic. And also she's somebody coming with flower from the street, from the sidewalk. And she's nothing. She was selling flowers, I think, in the street. And suddenly somebody very powerful took her on his protection, Dr. Schön, and she's so grateful. She was his whole life. And the interesting thing is that she provoked jealousy and suicide and everything, but she doesn't want anything. She only wants to live with him. And she's married with him, and she kills him. And in my production, she was killing him at the day of the wedding, I remember. Exactly like in the film. That was the idea by Pabst, not by me. It's a beautiful play.
Later you also did Wozzeck.
Yeah.
Some people find both Lulu and Wozzeck really miserable. They're totally dark.
Oh, it is dark. Yes, that's right.
And there really is no redeeming light in the situation or in the characters.
You can have all the time a redeeming light in every play.
What attracted you to the darkness?
I'm attracted in dark plays, that's for sure.
From the House of the Dead?
There is a lot of hope in the House of the Dead. House of the Dead has more hope and more life, more life than Wozzeck. But Wozzeck, at the same time, the achievement of Berg, the challenge of Berg was huge, trying to understand the madness, trying to understand the character of Wozzeck, and try to make him singing, which is difficult, you know. Berg make it a beautiful job about the play. Without Berg, the play probably will never be played again, the play itself by Büchner. I think the two operas by Berg are putting order in the plays he chose. And of course I'm attracted in those kind of story. I'm attracted by the dark side of the things, that's for sure. I was attracted. When you get older, you get less attracted, more.
From the House of the Dead is quite recent.
Well, from the House of the Dead, you are talking from a reality of the last centuries, which is the concentration camp, the prisoner camps. Somebody who dared, like Janáček, to make an opera with that has to be totally respected and honored, because it took the most burning problem of the 20th century.
John Mark Ainsley, the English tenor who played Skuratov, said to me, "Patrice is always profound, never decorative. There's a complete lack of French sentimentality."
I hope so.
And he also said,
I loved him very much working with him.
What he found as a singer was, from you, was ferocious attention to detail with the clear-eyed simplicity of a child. He says you have many childlike qualities, most of them good.
Okay, thank you.
Do you feel that? That
yes,
you approach every work with a kind of naivety?
Yes.
Purity?
Yes. That remains after so many years. Yeah. And also I want to play. I want to be happy on stage. I want to have fun during the rehearsals. And we were very happy, John Mark and I. Very happy. We were joking, really, a lot.
And Ruggero Raimondi says, he connects you to each character and situation. You learn as much about the others as about yourself in Patrice's rehearsals.
The character?
Yeah.
Yes, because when you want to tell a story, you have to connect everybody. You have to connect everybody. You have to teach the singers and also the actors, but the singers more. You have to teach how to know exactly what the other one is singing, what the other one is thinking, in which relationship you are with your partners, you know? And it's not natural. The singers are singing, you know, and they don't even know. I remember a terrible mess we have in Tristan and Isolde when I decided that Brangäner should stay on stage during the whole duet in the second act. That means that this poor Brangäner should learn the whole text. Because then she said, when she's singing that, you should hear her, Isolde, and you should react. I said, but how can I, the 40 minutes of text, you know, she should learn. She had to learn. It is unusual for singers, you know. They don't know what the other one is singing. I think it was one of the few things I'm doing well. Connect everybody together, to provoke, to have a group, to have an ensemble, to be together, you know. Usually the group, the 19 singers, for example, in House of the Dead, were really a beautiful group and really happy to do it again every time.
You've never worked in England. You're coming to the Young Vic next spring.
Yes.
Nobody's ever asked you before?
No.
Nobody from Covent Garden ever picked up the phone?
No. Nobody. At the Met, for example, in New York, nobody called me. The first one was Peter Gelb, who asked me in 2006, before I did the production of House of the Dead, to do it, to make the revival in New York.
You brought a visiting production once to the National Theatre in 1974.
Yes, and then finished. They had enough. With very bad reviews.
Yeah.
Maybe there is a connection.